Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the session. How are you feeling after today? Been a little bit tired, you know, been a bit saturated? Well, I've been reading an article about belly laughing. And belly laughing apparently is meant to completely re-energize you and allow you to really concentrate. So I thought we'd have three quick belly laughs. All you need to do is take a deep breath and then let the laugh come out from your belly. Up for that? Ready? So first deep breath. Ah! Wasn't very good. Come on. It energizes you all, not just the few in you that drink the right beer. Another deep breath. Ah! And one final one. Deep breath. Ah! Well, I feel better anyway. And I've been told when in this article it says it does wonders for sex as well. But it doesn't say whether to do it before, during, or after. And I'm going to leave that research to yourselves. So my name's John Craddock. I am a consultant based in the UK, or I have cover title of architect, in fact. I work pretty much around the world these days, and one of my specialities is Active Directory. And I started working with Active Directory sort of before it came out at all, so very, very early releases. And I think in those days they were called alphas. I think we went alphas, betas, and we didn't have release candidates in those days. And one day I got a call from Microsoft UK, and they said, "I hear you know something about Active Directory." And I said, "Yes." And they said, "Could you come and skill us up on it?" And it was one of those conversations. I put down the phone, and it was a duh moment. And, you know, as I was driving out to Microsoft, I think, "This can't be true. This can't be true." Anyway, I formed my relationship back with Microsoft in about 1999, or very early days in 1999. I presented at the launch of 2000 Active Directory, and I've been very, very much involved with it ever since. So what are we going to cover today? Because I've got the privilege now of talking about Windows Server 2012 Active Directory. So what does it give us? There's some GUI enhancements which are really great for doing things that perhaps you should argue or could argue that we should have been able to do a long time ago. But they're there now. We've also got a much simplified and much more robust DC installation capability. How many of you have virtualized DCs? Okay, that's probably only about a third of the audience. A lot of DCs, it's an ideal candidate for virtualization, and more people are doing it. However, it's potentially very dangerous to virtualize a DC because you can do things that completely break your AD. All right? However, 2012 is now virtualization safe. And if you do have a virtualized DC environment, then you can very rapidly deploy using DC cloning. And I'll be going into more detail of that. Another very interesting feature that's been added is the implementation of claims within the Kerberos token. Kerberos token, there's been a lot of work on that, but now we can actually put claims. And what is a claim? A claim is an attribute from the directory that you designate as being a claim. So if you wanted, you could put the office location string as a claim inside your Kerberos token. I'll go into more detail of that as we go through the session. We can control access to files and folders using dynamic access control. Again, what does that give us? We need to look at it. Rid pool protection. If you wanted me to, I could completely destroy your Active Directory with a very small change to the registry on your FSMO role holder for the RID master. But now that's been protected against. They obviously knew I was around. All right. There's other issues with the RID pool which have again been sorted out. PowerShell absolutely everywhere, and there's more. Now, what I'm not going to cover is I'm not going to go into 2012 R2 Active Directory. The product group wanted to do that. Actually, I think the product group wanted a trip to Madrid, but that's a different story. If you're interested in that, I've listed three sessions there which will give you the added features that now come in R2. And there's some very, very interesting stuff around particularly a web application proxy, where you can actually publish applications, but authenticate, and you can authenticate using federated identities. And those identities could be from your own AD, they could be from the Windows Azure AD as well. So do have a look at those sessions if you're interested. So Active Directory, we all know and love it. We could probably all describe it to our friends what it is, right? But now that when you're down the pub and someone says, I'm running Active Directory, you have to say to them, which one? Because Active Directory has become an umbrella name. It's become an umbrella name for the Windows Active Directory that we all know and love. You host it, you look after it, you could host it on premises, you could also host it in the cloud. And if you're interested in how to host Active Directory in the Windows Azure cloud, come to my session on Thursday morning, where I will be going into the details of that. So how do you actually put an Active Directory, and why might you want to put an Active Directory into the Windows Azure cloud? So it's completely yours to look after and manage, so infrastructure and the data. And then there's the services that we all know, Active Directory directory services, lightweight directory services, certificate services, and so on. And that is known as Windows Active Directory, or WAD. And now there's a new Active Directory, which is the Windows Azure Active Directory, or known as WAAD. So you can ask someone, do you run WAD or do you run WAD? Interesting conversations over a pint of beer, I think. So what is that? Microsoft hosts it in their data centers, completely looked after by Microsoft. So they're looking after the infrastructure. You don't touch that. You manage the data that's in it. So you can put users. You can have users in the Windows Azure Active Directory. You can have attributes of users and so on. Think of it as a directory store. You don't really know how it's implemented. It's implemented up in the cloud. It's a very high availability, very high reliability directory in the cloud. In terms of services, today there's the directory services. In terms of authentication, there's no Kerberos, there's no NTLM v2. It's all about federated authentication. So we're using WS Federation, we're using SAML, we're using Auth version 2, OAuth, and there's more to come in that front. And there's also the access control service, which is part of that. I just want to give you a very, very quick demo. And I'm just going to switch over and go to my demo machine. And I don't want to show you the time. And if I've got a link on here, which is taking me up to SharePoint in the cloud. And I'm hitting SharePoint in the cloud, and I'm using the access control service, which is part of the Windows Azure Active Directory, to basically broker identity. So how would you like to log on to this SharePoint in the cloud? Do you want to use a Windows Live ID? Okay, we could use that. And we're asked to sign in to Windows Live ID. Or I could use a Google ID. And again, we can sign in using a Google ID. I could have included in here Facebook as well. I could have included my own AD, so I could actually be authenticating using my own AD. But here I'm going to use a user from the Azure AD. So I'm just going to log in as John at... By the way, that is not my email. It won't actually get to me. You'll see my email at the end of the session. And I've just got to remember the password. And now, this is SharePoint federated in the cloud. It's actually sitting up in the Azure portal. But what I've really wanted to show you was the ability, by using the Windows Azure Active Directory, to broker between different identity providers. And also, I can log in using Azure. That's the sort of last bit about the Windows Azure Active Directory. If you're interested, there are other sessions on that this week. I will cover it in a little bit more detail on when I'm setting the scene on my session on Thursday morning, when I'm looking at running Windows. I'm looking at running WAD in the Windows Azure space, so on virtual machines. So we can also synchronize between our own AD and into the Windows Azure AD. So what I want to do in terms of RAD is actually start off with a demo of actually the GUI enhancements. And I'm going to be running this on, I've got a couple of DCs running just to show you this. Let's go over to DC number one. And we can use the administrative center in here. So we go to tools, administrative center. And as I say, these are two enhancements which probably should have been around for a while. But let's just click on that. Notice dynamic access control. There's a node in here which deals with dynamic access control. I'm going to tell you what it is, but I'm not going to have time to go into the detail of how we use it. But if we go into our own AD, and looking down here, there is no deleted objects container. But I can simply come over, click on here, enable the recycle bin. Yes, please. And the recycle bin's enabled. If I do a refresh, I have my deleted objects. And there aren't any at the moment. So if I've got an OU structure where I've got demo A, I've got demo B, and I've got some users in demo B, OU, and some in demo A, I'm simply going to come up to demo A and delete it. So now it just wants me to confirm it. They've all gone. Where are they? They're in the deleted objects container. So Harry was sitting down in demo B. So I'm going to grab Harry, and I'm going to restore him. And it's saying I can't do it because the parent doesn't exist anymore. No problem. Locate the parent. Restore. And again, I can't do it because this is demo B, and demo B had a parent of demo A. So let's find that parent. Restore. And then we know we need to restore demo B. And then I can simply take all my users and I do a restore. And they're all back. And they're all back with all of their attributes, their group membership, all the things that they should have. So that solved that problem. The other thing that is becoming more and more popular is the ability to set password policies. How many of you use password policies today? Okay, so probably a good 25% of the audience. Active Directory is becoming much more of a service within an organization. So you offer Active Directory as the authentication management service to different parts of your organization. And different parts of your organization may want different password policies. Well, traditionally, you've had to set password policies at domain level, and you know, everyone has the same thing. So it was one of the justifications for having multiple domains, because you wanted different password policies. Now you can set password policies. They're set against groups or against individual users. So I can now create a password policy. So I can go into the password settings container, new password policy, and I'm going to create a password policy here, and I'm going to name it nasty. And we need a precedence number because the precedence number is a tiebreaker in case there's two password policies against the same user or group that that user is a member of. And so I'm just going to put a value of 10 in there. And then what we'll do is we'll just change that to 200. I think you can understand why it's a bit nasty. And we don't like Harry. So we'll add Harry in there. And now Harry has this rather interesting password policy. Always another issue is who's got which policy. If we just go back into demo A, down to demo B, we can now look and see the resultant password settings. And Harry has the nasty policy against him. And Peter there, if we look at the resultant policy on there, he hasn't got a specific password settings object against him, and therefore he's using the domain password policy. So, again, another very, very useful feature, but probably one of the most useful features is the ability of looking at PowerShell history. And so everything I've just been doing has been recorded and is available as the PowerShell history. So if I just copy that and pop that in there, I've got the starting point. And the other thing you can do, if it's starting point for my PowerShell script, the other thing you can do is you can start a task. And you can give it a task name. And then you can do a series of operations in the AD. And that series of operation is blocked together under that particular task. So it gives you a very, very good starting point for starting to script with PowerShell. How many of you use PowerShell? Okay, that's really good. That's over a third of the audience. Bottom line is that everyone should be using PowerShell, and PowerShell should be becoming your new best friend. How many of you use NetSH? Oh, very few hands. Okay, probably maybe 15, 20 hands went up. NetSH is going to be basically superseded with PowerShell. So if you've been using NetSH but looking at your IP configuration, et cetera, start looking at the PowerShell commands for that. In terms of installing domain controllers, we run DC Promo, and now it gives you a little message saying, don't use DC Promo, it doesn't exist anymore. So I guess DC Promo, rest in peace. And then you actually go into the server manager, and it sort of fires up DC Promo. So it's DC Promo looking new, squeaky, clean. There is no advanced mode anymore. Okay, so we go through the process, we install the Active Directory domain services, and then going on from there, it will put in the appropriate role and feature. It look out all the time for little places where it says export configuration settings. So all the time you can get XMLs out of the system, you can get PowerShell out of the system, and so on. So again, if you're not really familiar with PowerShell, look for the help that's already there so you can actually extract this information. You can run it remotely. So I can simply look at my servers in one view, one consolidated view, right-click, install the role, and then start the promotion process. So we start off in Server Manager. It tells us we've got a post-deployment configuration step, which is basically the promotion we need to do. And then it starts off, and it says, you know, you're all familiar with this. Add a domain controller, you know, create a new forest, etc. So nothing particularly new in that screen. However, if you want to put it in to an existing, so you want to bring your first 2012 domain controller in, did I say anything about doing an AD prep? Provided your target forest is Server 2003, functionality level or higher, you don't have to worry anymore about AD prep. It's going to bring your new 2012 DC into place. I'll talk more about that in 1 second. Next job is it a domain controller? Is it a global catalog? Is it got DNS? Is it RODC? Where would you like to put it in terms of site? And your Active Directory restore mode. So again, nothing particularly new there. And then we come on to the DNS delegation records. You remember all the time it says, oh, I can't put a DNS delegation record in for you. I don't have permission. Now you can set the appropriate account to actually go and do that DNS delegation. So if you can do it, you can actually now put in the credentials for that. Next job is we specify install from media if you want to. How many of you done an install from media? Okay, so just very, very few hands. Concept behind install from media is you've got a running DC, it's got its big database on it, and you create what's referred to as an IFM or install from media seed. And you use NTDS util to do that. All right? So it creates it, and then as part of the creation of a new DC, you use this seed. So this seed has a copy of the database on it, and you take it over to your new DC, and when you bring it up and do the promotion process, it can actually take the information from there rather than having to replicate it across the network. So it's a great solution for branch offices where you've got slow WAN links, etc. Now, one of the caveats, when you created an IFM seed using the NTDS utility, is what it required to happen was, having created a copy of your database, it wanted to do an offline defrag on it. All right? Not an online, but an offline. So what's the difference between an online and an offline defrag of your AD database? Man's going to answer back there with a red hat. Okay, absolutely perfect answer. So online, basically, you've got pages in the database. And when you do an online defrag, which happens automatically on a regular basis, it simply cleans up the pages in the database. When you do an offline defrag, it actually crunches the overall DIT size, right? And that, if you've got a very, very large DIT, can take an awful long time. And therefore, you know, you're about to do a DC promo, and you go, oh my goodness me, I better come back in 5 hours' time when NTDS util has finished doing the offline defrag. Now what you can do is you can actually set it, and by default it still does it, but you can tell NTDS util not to do an offline defrag. Okay, so on we go again, and now we set in, again, we're all familiar with this, where our database, our log files, our sysvol is going to be. And the next job, it says to install domain controller, the wizard needs to perform the following operation, all right? And to be able to do that operation, it's going to do a forest prep, and it's going to do a domain prep. To be able to do that, obviously, it needs the appropriate credentials. So if you're doing a forest prep, what credentials do you need? Yes, schema admin. Okay. You may not want to do it here. You may want to do it prior to actually bringing this DC up. Let your schema admin do the forest prep for you. Okay. But you can do it. Now, there's nothing about sort of, you know, choosing a particular DC to run this on, right? So where do you do your forest prep? Which DC? On which FSMO role? Shout it out. Thank you very much. There's lots of aircon noise here, and I can't hear. Schema master, excellent answer. Where do you do your domain prep? Yell it out. Domain prep? Do you remember? See, you don't remember. Well, no, you don't need to, because it will do it for you. You actually do it on the infrastructure master. Why? Because they had to choose a single DC that you did it on, right? And just the infrastructure master, well, what do we need that for? Oh, let's do the domain prep on it as well, all right? So now it's a little integrated program that just sorts it all out, works out where your FSMO roles are, and does it for you. It's integrated in here, and it will do it, provided it's got the right credentials. Otherwise, you can run it, all right? But you don't have to worry about which DC you're running it on. It sorts all that out. So another thing that we come on, it gives you a sort of review of your selections. And then having done that, you've got the ability to use PowerShell, and you can grab it all with PowerShell, so you can grab the PowerShell script. And then what it does is it does a complete prereqs check. But what it's actually been doing is all the way through the process, it's been checking as it goes. So it doesn't wait till you get to the end and says, hey, you can't promote me. It does it all the way through and will tell you if there's a problem. And so if there is a final validation, but you've got it all the way through. Okay, so that is the DC promo process. I'm going to call it DC promo. It's, or if you like, the domain controller promotion process rather than, and I say it's a lot more robust than it was previously, and we don't have to worry about, as long as we're at 2003 functionality level, then we can just bring our 2012 servers in, and it worries about all the AD prep and the forest prep. When it comes to DC virtualization, this has been a real potential problem, because people thought, oh, I know, I can do snapshots, I can restore my directory from the snapshot. Anyone done a restore from a snapshot? Successfully? How did you get on? It's problematic. Why is it problematic? Well, it's interesting just to look at that. In terms of replication, what we have is we have two databases, a database on each DC. And it's not the DC that's the database. The database is sitting on there, and the database has a name, which is identified by the invocation ID GUID. I've just made it really simple. That guy on the left is E. The guy on the right is M. And you have, on the DC as well, a USN, update sequence number. Every time a change is made, that update sequence number bounces up. Okay, totally independent of all the update sequence numbers on all the other DCs. So how do you know after replication that you've got everything? Well, what you do is you hold a vector on a database. So the guy on the left is holding a vector on database M, and he says, I've had everything up to 3,000. The guy on the right is saying, I've had everything up to 1,000 from the E database. Not the server, the database. So we take a snapshot. Having taken the snapshot, time moves on, as it does. And then we make some changes, replication takes place, and now the guy on the left is a vector, which is the M database. He's had everything up to 5, 6, 7, 9, so he's fully in sync. This guy is from the E database has had everything up to 4, 5, 6, 7, so he's fully in sync. And time goes on, and the guy on the right collapses. You say, no problem, we took a snapshot, didn't we? So let's just restore it. So we restore the snapshot. Can anyone see a potential problem there? The guy on the right is saying, I've had everything up from M up to 5, 6, 7, 9. But where is M? M is at 3,000. The guy on the right says, I've had everything to E up to 1,000. Okay? That's not a problem, because E's sitting up at 4, 5, 6, 7. He'll happily replicate everything over that's missing. But what about in the other direction? So we end up with a situation where, if we'll make it a little bit more tricky, we'll add some users over here. So now we're up to 3050. We've just created a whole bunch of 50 users. All right? So now 50 users are sitting on that domain controller. Send me a change since 1000. No problem. Here they come. Everything replicates beautifully. Send me a change from 5, 6, 7, 9. There aren't any. Because 5, 6, 7, 9 is way above currently 3050. So he says, I've got no changes for you. And that is the best way to destroy your Active Directory, leave your users on there. It's referred to as a USN bubble. It actually gets worse because you can get SID reuse, all sorts of nasty things happening to you. So what Microsoft did in 2003, Service Pack 1, they introduced quarantining. And send me your changes from 5, 6, 7, 9. There aren't any. That's a bit strange. How come he's more up to date than I am? Because I'm the authoritative source for this. So what at that point, the DC would write an event. Having written an event, it would disable inbound and outbound replication and stop the net log on service. So he basically says, I'm not good enough to be a DC anymore. And you've just lost one of your DCs. But something nasty could have happened before then. So there was a guidance. I don't know, out of all those hands that went up, about running DCs in a virtualized environment. How many of you read the Microsoft guidance on doing it? That's probably about half the hands, right? Maybe. So congratulations to all of you that read the guidance. Now, what's happened? In Server 2012, there's some clever stuff that's going on. The hypervisor creates what's referred to as a VM generation ID GUID. And it's 128 bits long. And it exposes that to the guest OS via the BIOS ACPI namespace. Actually, it only exposes 64 bits of it in 232-bit blocks, to be precise. And the DC stores it on promotion in a GUID in the database. And it's continually checking the one exposed through the hypervisor against the one that's been stored. And if there isn't a match, then it says I've gone back in time. Something nasty has happened. So it's set during a VM import, a copy, or an application of a snapshot. And actually, this introduces a very interesting thing when you're running the Active Directory in virtual machines in Windows Azure. And I will cover that issue on Thursday morning. So DC boots, or it notices the VM generation ID has changed. So it's not just at boot time. What it does, it assumes that something nasty has happened and it needs to go into AD restore mode. So what it will do is it will change its invocation ID GUID, so it will become a new database. Right? So remember that vector that was being held on a database? That vector becomes invalid because that database doesn't exist anymore. So we've now got a new invocation ID GUID. And having done that, what it does is it discards its RID pool to prevent RID reuse. The RID, if you're not familiar with it, is the back end of the SID. Right? It's when you've got a security ID, the RID is the back end of that. And then what it does is a non-authoritative restore of sysvol. And again, the challenges around Windows Azure is that last feature, and I will discuss that, let's say, on Thursday. Hypervisor support, there's more and more hypervisor support coming out, but at the moment, obviously, the Windows family supports it. Windows 8 Professional supports it as well, and Enterprise. And we've also got support on the 2012 hypervisor, and then you've got VM Workstation, vSphere, et cetera. But I expect that list to get a lot bigger. And actually, I put this slide together probably 4 weeks ago, so the list may be bigger already. Okay, so I want to give you a quick demo of how we are virtualization safe. And I'm going to start off on my DC number 2. So go to DC 2. And what I'm going to do is, that's not DC. Yep, thank you. See, I left it off deliberately to see if anyone was watching. So congratulations, that person. So we go over to DC 2, and if I look inside my event log, what I've got here is a event 2168, and what it says, the DC is running on a supported hypervisor, VM generation ID detected, and that's the VM generation ID. Let's just grab that. Let's just pop that into Notepad. And the next thing that happens is that it's the 2172 says the current, in fact, actually, I don't know how good the resolution is. Can you read that at the back of the room? No. Okay. Then I'll just pop that into Notepad as well. So that's big enough in Notepad, is it? Yep. Okay, great. So we've got an MSDH. This is the one that's held in the Active Directory, and those two guys are the same. And then you start wondering, well, where did this come from? And so if you drill into your XML for your hypervisor, and where is my XML for my hypervisor? Down here somewhere. Hyper-V, DC1, and virtual machines. And there's my XML. And I go edit and find on that, and look for the generation ID. There it is. Down there, let's move that down right to the, actually, I'll squeeze that in at the bottom. It's going to be a bit tight. And there we've got, okay, so I've got a slightly smaller font on this. Can you see the font on that? Yeah. So there's the generation ID, and there it is sitting here. And you can see they're absolutely identical. No? Okay. Do you remember I said it's 128-bit number, but it only uses 64 bits? Right? It's the lower 64 bits that are exposed through the ACPI BIOS. And this really bugged me for a while until generation ID, that is not, what am I looking at? I've looked at DC1. It's not the right generation ID. Yep. Let's go to DC too, otherwise we'll get really confused. Okay, so just find that. And there it is. Let's take the lower 64 bits of that, and let's just use the calculator. And pop the, I've already had calculator open because I just double checked it before we started. So let's I'll just paste that in, which is the same number, convert it to decimal, and you will see that those numbers, actually I can leave that up, can't I? Those numbers now, let's go back to, yeah, those numbers now match. So if you ever need to troubleshoot something, you want to check your VM generation ID GUID, you now know how to do it. Okay, so let's, on DC2, let's create ourselves a new user, and we might as well use, just to prove it still exists, Active Directory using computers. And in fact, I'm not going to create a user, I'm going to create a group. The reason being that it's just a lot quicker to create a group. So new group, and I'm going to call this one. So it's a new group created. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to snapshot this guy. So DC2 snapshotted, and we'll call it demo. Yes to that. And then what we'll do is, oh, we'll do something previously we should never have been able to do. We'll revert it. Okay, so my DC2 has just been reverted. Okay, we might as well actually, while we're here, we'll create another new user or new group, and we'll call this 2. Okay, let's have a look at the event log now, and what we should find is that if we do a refresh on here, we've got this one here, which basically says and let's grab that so we can see it. In fact, what I'll do is I'll zoom that. So it's what it's done, it's detected a change in the generation ID GUID. So it then immediately aborts any transactions it was doing. So this one is actually just telling us it's aborting the transaction because the virtual machine has reverted to a previous state. And then what it tells us it's going to do is it's detected a change, and this is going to be a bit tricky for the back row. It's going to create a new invocation ID GUID, it's going to invalidate the RID pool, and the ownership of the FISMO role is going to be validated, next inbound replication. It's going to start sysvol replication restore and request a new RID pool. So effectively, it's going to do an AD restore of itself. And having done that, what it will do is it will come up and be absolutely happy and carry on. Now, let's just use in here LDP, and let's just, not sure which server I'm binding to, so that's okay. Yep, so if we drill down, and I can't preset this, so let's just change the font size. Let's go to 16 point on that. If I actually go down into my tree, okay, and let's just drill down in here. And let's look at one. And one is my user number one, my group number one, has a RID of 1607. Okay? So that's the relative identifier at the end of the SID. So who's going to tell me roughly what the RID is going to be? And I don't expect you to be 100% accurate, you'll be roughly accurate, of number two. 2100, goodness me. Anyone agree? Anyone disagree? Ah, okay, you've got no one voting for you. Let's have a look. Let's go and have a look. Okay, 2102. Are we gonna let him get away with that? It's close enough. And why did you say 2100? Yes, absolutely right. Ridpool block size is 500. So it invalidated the Ridpool, chucked it away, and went and got a new Ridpool. All right, so it was bumped up by 500. So that shows you the way this operates. And the other thing I just want to show you very quickly is if we actually go and just grab one other thing, which is I want to get the 1109 event from here. 1109, let's just grab that. Oh, too much. And just pop that into Notepad. So what it's done is it's changed. There's the old invocation ID. That's the name of the database, effectively. You can think of that. That's the new one. If I go across to DC number one, and I want to show you this for two reasons. One is I mentioned that there's, let's just increase the font size on that, just make it a little bit bigger for the back row. And let's just push that up to 20 point. I'll just mention to you that there's a whole bunch of new PowerShell stuff. And what we can do is we can do a get AD, and you could cycle through that, and there's lots and lots of AD stuff. What I want to do is just do AD replication, because this is where the new stuff has really come in. So getting the metadata connections, partner metadata, queue operations in replication, site information, site links, site link bridges, subnets, and this is the up-to-dateness vectors. And what I'm going to do in here is just put in AD DC1, so it's going to get it on AD DC1. And what you'll see here is we've got a replication that's taken place at 1640, and F02D4, we just go to DC2. So the, hang on, I've chosen the wrong thing there. Let's just go back here. Where are we? Sorry, we've got the replication here at 1640 to 47 AD, and also to recently it's 4288, and also, if we can remember that number, 1248. And if we go back to DC number 2, and 4288 and 1248. So this is the new one it's replicating with now, and that's the old one. So DC1 just happily says, oh, I've got this vector on this database, but the database doesn't exist anymore, all right? But it's going to hold that vector until eventually it gets aged out. All right? It's just in case. It doesn't know whether that database has gone forever or just the DC is unavailable, all right? So that gives you the virtualization safe capability. If we look at cloning uses a similar concept. It needs the VM generation ID. But the advantage of cloning is you can deploy DCs really, really rapidly. So you take a source DC that, you know, you've promoted. First thing you do is you need a PDC emulator, which is Windows Server 2012. You absolutely have to have that, because what it does is that when you put your PDC emulator on a Windows Server 2012, it creates this group called clonable domain controllers, all right? And any DC that you're going to clone has to be in that group. Go and look for that group. It won't exist until your PDC emulator is on a 2012 server. Next job is it checks for incompatible components, and these are components that Microsoft consider incompatible, that they know about. They can't know that you installed the Hoochie Coochie 2072 app that is superb within your company, so they can't say whether that's clonable. These are all the things they know about. Next job is you remove incompatible apps or you declare them safe. All right, so if you do some testing, you say they're safe, and I'll show you how we do that in a second. We get a DC clone XML file, which we load on. And then what we do is we shut down and we make a copy. That DC clone XML file, you can load it onto your machine before you clone it, or you can service your VM image offline and add it. or you can put it on a USB stick. So when you clone, when you start up your DC that you're going to be cloning, you could have that XML on the USB stick. So you create a new VM, you fire it up, and what it does, it says, oh, look, my VM generation ID GUID has changed. Do I have a DC clone config XML available to me? Is it in the NTDS directory, or is it on a USB stick? And yes, if it is, it says, I'm going to be a clone. Right, and it starts up, and the job's done. So it's this boot process is almost like, you know, if you used to do sysprep, right, it's the same time as sysprep takes to operate, probably slightly shorter, actually. You can't sysprep a DC, but now you can clone them. So it's another, possibly another good reason for going through and using virtualization on your DCs, because there's rapid deployment of DCs. You know, if you ever have faced a disaster and need to do an AD restore, the ability to clone out your DCs could be an absolute winner. You then get, you know, this thing ticks away saying the domain controller cloning is 90% complete. It doesn't stick at this screen, by the way. It does finish. The DC clone allow list basically is there. It says, you know, what any service or application they're running are not included in that list, then what it's going to do, it's going to complain at you. And what I'll do is I'll do a demo of this at the moment, and I'll also show you. So I'll leave this as reference, and we'll do a quick demo. The other thing is the DC clone config file, you can put a lot of information on it. A little bit of PowerShell, and you can put in the IPv4 addresses, the IPv6 addresses, the default gateway, the site name, and all the bits and pieces that you need. So when you bring this, you can have this on a USB stick, plug it in the machine, bring it up, and whoosh, you're away. Okay, so let's do a very quick cloning demo. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my DC number 2, and I'm just going to go through the cloning steps on this. So let's do a little bit of a cleanup, gets rid of some of this junk, and switch over. See, nobody noticed still. You must all be asleep. Not enough belly laughing, obviously. So now we're going to fire up command prompt, and again, for our friends on the back row, I'm just going to increase the font size on that. And having increased the font size, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a get and get DC, where are we? Get ADDC, that's what I was thinking I was going wrong. ADDC clone exclusion list and run that. And it tells me the browser's not compatible. And you think, hey, come on, browser's part of the Microsoft thing. And absolutely right, it is compatible. What I've done is I've gone down and I've actually modified the list itself. So if I go down into Windows System 32, and I go down to default, let's try again. Default DC clone allow list. What I've done, open up in Notepad. These are all things Microsoft consider compatible, and down there is, it should say browser, but just for the sake of the demo, I changed that to browsers, all right? But the other thing that you do is you actually, the best thing to do is to run, rather than sort of checking things like that, is you go new, and it's ADDC clone config file. And you can run that. And what it does is it does all the checks that are necessary. So pass, the domain controller hosting the FISMO role is server 2012. Pass, the local domain controller is a member of the clonable domain controllers group. And then it's failed on that compatibility. And what I can do is I can do my testing. Let's say that's your Hoochie Coochie 20,000 application. You test it, absolutely sure it's clonable. And then what you do is you do a get ADDC DC cloning exclude application list again, and you put in there generate XML. And it generates an XML and adds that to a custom XML file. And then we can finally rerun the one new ADC cloning file. But what I'm going to do is use one that I've created earlier to add some more detail. And what we've got here is the ability to add the IPv4 address, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to run that one. And we'll pop that in there. And it's validated everything, and it's quite happy. It's all worked. Where did it put everything that's important? It actually pushed it. By default, it puts it into the NTDS settings directory. Oh, sorry, not the NTDS settings directory, but the NTDS directory. And it's down there. So there's my custom clone allow list, which has browser in it. Remember, previously browser failed, so that's been passed. And then if we look at the clone config file, it's created that for me, and it's ready to go. So now all I need is a server, right, which has got 2012 on it, and then I can clone my DC and bring it up. So as I say, extremely rapid deployment. And I would, with this capability and now virtualization being safe, I really think about running DCs in a virtualized environment. Okay, so next thing, Kerberos enhancements. Kerberos, there's a number of changes to Kerberos. Anyone suffer from Kerberos token explosion? Okay, so quite a few hands, maybe 20 hands went up. So number one, they've increased the maximum Kerberos SSPI context buffer size. So Kerberos isn't quite so cramped anymore. One of the problems with Kerberos is that in this thing called the privilege attribute certificate, privilege attribute certificate, there's all your group membership. It sits in there, all your universal group, global group membership. And that, when it gets too big, can make your token size absolutely enormous. Now they've got compression on that, all right, which is a great benefit. Plus, there's warning events when you're getting to a large token size. Previously, things just stopped working when you ended up with token explosion. And there's a lot more logging available. The major changes are support for constrained delegation and also claims support. So in terms of constrained delegation, how many of you do Kerberos constrained delegation? Okay, so probably maybe 20, 25 hands going up. The idea of constrained delegation is that, let's say we've got a web front end, and then we've got a back end server of some kind. User comes to the web front end, logs in, and what we want to do is be able to impersonate them to the back end system. All right? And you can do that with Kerberos delegation, but Kerberos delegation is extremely dangerous. So we use constrained delegation, where we define which services we can actually delegate to. So from the front end, where we can actually go to with our delegation. Right? The caveat to that is the service account running on the website and the service account running the back-end system needed to be in the same domain. Right? Now that is no longer true. Right? So what we can have is we can have a front-end service account talking to a service account in a different domain, talking to a service account in a different forest, right? And we can actually put in a trust to enable that delegation to happen. So that limitation, which was causing a lot of people a lot of grief, I came across it an awful lot with SharePoint, where SharePoint is going out to all sorts of back-end services, and I can see quite a lot of nods as to the SharePoint issue. So that's great. The other problem, and this is a real problem potentially, is that all of this delegation stuff was done in the AD. All right. So if I was an AD administrator, and I know an awful lot of companies that don't control the actual setting of that delegation correctly, right? They're a bit lax about it because, to be honest, they don't understand it. And I tried to, I proposed a session called Taming the Three-Headed Dog for Tech Ed. Unfortunately, they didn't accept it because it was all about Kerberos and the new enhancements to it and so on. But one of the things is delegation is done up in the AD, and the guy running the back-end server had no control over who was being delegated to them. All right? Now you can do it. So you can actually set on that back-end server principals allowed to delegate to account. All right? So we can actually control who can actually come to this back-end system. And it's in control now of the application owner. And that's again, a very, very important feature. So those who do delegation or are going to do delegation, 2012 has some real solutions for it. This is very interesting. Previously, our pack was just filled with group membership. Now what we can do is we can add to that pack, we can add user claims, and we can add device groups and device claims. All right. Now, what does it say? Claim was, a claim is simply an Active Directory attribute that's been marked as a claim, and the attribute value will then be added. So use the example of the office location string, but it could be anything you like, all right? Manager, whatever you want to put in there. Device claims is an attribute of the device. All right. Obviously, the group associated with the device is associated with the group that, well, is the group the device is a member of. Now, what does that do for us? Not a lot, unless we can use it on our back-end systems. And this is where dynamic access control comes in. So now what we can do, files can actually be classified. They can be tagged. This is files and folders. And access and audit policies can be based on the file classification. So I can now have an access policy based on anything that's tagged as sales or anything that's tagged as marketing. Right? Expression-based access control and auditing. So I can now mix in that expression-based control, groups and claims. So I can say, If you are from the London office, all right, because a marked office is being a claim, and your job title is manager, and you are sitting down at a device that is managed by HR, allow access. So you can get really rich access control. And the ability to bring devices in there allows you to have additional control, obviously. So you end up with something here. I've got an example here. User department equals corporate sales. User's job title equals sales manager. And device department is corporate sales. Allow access. All right. So that comes in. And the other thing is start looking at what's happening in the 2012 R2 space, with the web application proxy and the ability to use and consume claims. And you're going to have a very, very rich model. So I think I probably actually said everything there. Yes. OK, in terms of enabling Kerberos for claims, what you do is you basically turn on FAST, or claims-based authentication support. FAST is Flexible Authentication Secure Tunneling. And it does a number of things. It actually protects the initial channel that you have when the user authenticates. When the user authenticates, basically the user says, I'm John, right? And it sends that to the KDC. And as part of the saying, I'm John, what he does is he encrypts, right, a little piece of the token, which is effectively the timestamp with a hash of the password. Right, if you use a weak password, it's possible to sniff that off the net and then do a dictionary attack and crack this thing until you get a timestamp back, and then you've got the hash, and then you do an attack on the hash. And so you can actually break the Kerberos system. Now with FAST enabled, it protects you against that attack. So if you're using smart card, it's not an issue. because the smart card key is big enough. If you're using decent passwords, it's not an issue. But if you're using slightly weaker passwords, it could be an issue. But now you're fully protected. The other thing is you can do spoofing very easily with Kerberos. So basically someone says, oh, I'm trying to authenticate with you with Kerberos. And you say, I don't do Kerberos. So you spoof an error message back. So it falls back and uses a weaker authentication mechanism. Now the Kerberos error messages are signed. And of course, it also gives you this capability of compound identity where you have user and device information in the Kerberos token. So not only the user's context, but also the context, the device that user is sitting at. Okay, the other thing they've done a lot of work on is exhaustible resources. One of the things is you have this in the directory, you have a thing called a distinguished name tag. So you add an object into the directory, it goes in a row in the database. The front, that row has a distinguished name tag. Think of it as the row identifier. You add another, has a, goes up, goes up, goes up. You delete a few, doesn't matter. Still keeps going up. The DNT climbs up and up and up and up and up. It has a maximum limit of 2 billion. You say, well, I don't have 2 billion objects in my AD. But if your AD's been around for a while, and you've added things, you've taken things away, you've upgraded, and you've gone through the process, the DNT can start to approach that 2 million marker. But there's been no way, unless you've done a complete database dump, okay, which is not an easy thing to do, of actually knowing where the DNT is. Now it's exposed. It's exposed as the approximate highest internal object ID. Now, if your DNT hits that mark, it's not a problem. What you do is you basically demote the domain controller and repromote it, all right? Because at that point, when you repromote, all the objects will go back in at lower DNTs. It's just that the DNT is never reused, you end up with these chunks of space that are that are in the directory, but the DNT just keeps going up and up and up. If you want to see that, and it's not obvious at all, you read the documentation, it's, oh yes, I can now look at my DNT. It's not obvious how you do it, and I'll just quickly show you that. It's an attribute of root DSE. Now, if we go to our DC, and I'm going to use LDP to do this, so we'll just run up LDP, and let's think I'm connected to the wrong server. Yes, I am. So just delete that. Okay, so I'm going to connect and bind to this server. Okay. And then what we'll do is we'll just bring the font size up, and let's take it up to 16 point. Okay, so this is when you connect, you get this dump of what's called root DSE. And I haven't got time to go into the detail of it, but every domain controller has a root DSE, and it sort of describes the domain controller's state and capability. It's not attributes within the AD. They're special attributes, and it's part of the LDAP standard. Now, you will never, ever see this approximate highest internal object ID. There's the dump, but it's not there. So you say, okay, well, let's go find this thing. And if you want to dump root DSE, you do a search against the directory with a null DN, and the object class equals star, and the base you do it at base level. Let's put a star in here, and that which basically means return all attributes. Again, you will not see it. And the reason being, it is a constructed attribute. And if you ever want to see a constructed attribute, you have to specifically ask for it. So what I'm going to do is just clear that off. And I'm just going to go to my desktop a second to save me typing this in. And go back into LDP and just put that in as the attribute name. And now we run it, and it immediately brings it back. So my DNT is currently 4072. So if you've been going through a process of with your AD and you know it's sort of been around for a long time, check the DNT. And if it's approaching this high marker, then you can say to yourself, okay, at some point we need to reschedule a demotion of this domain controller and a repromotion. The other thing that is exhaustible is RIDs. And RIDs can be exhaustible for a number of reasons. So a SID, the back end of it, it has the relative identifier on it. And every time a new security principle is created, the RID goes up, all right? But because we're working in a distributed environment, so that DC over there needs to create RIDs, this one here needs to create RIDs, and that one over there needs to create RIDs, we need to distribute blocks of RIDs to these different DCs, right? And when they get close to exhausting the block of RIDs they're using, they come back and ask for more. And who do they come back to? They come back to the RID master. Now, if we look at the maximum number of RIDs you can ever have in the directory, it's a fairly large number. It's 1,073 million RIDs. And if you look at the sort of maths of it and you create 10,000 RIDs per day, so 10,000 security principles a day, it'll last you 294 years. And obviously, when Microsoft designed this originally, they thought, you know, I mean, Bill Gates thought, I'm not going to be around in 294 years, so is it an issue? But the problem is, it can be an issue, and it can be an issue for a number of reasons. You have a rogue script, which is creating millions of security principles, all right? That could be an issue. You have a very large RID block size set. Now, the gentleman there in the red hat said the RID block size is 500. But a lot of organizations increase the size. And it used to be an issue, because what would happen is you'd run a script, and I came across this with particularly with universities, which suddenly brought in a whole lot of new students. So they'd be creating, you know, thousands of new security principles. What would happen is you'd be creating on this thing with your script, it would be eating RIDs, all right? And suddenly, you'd run out of RIDs. The reason being is the time between realizing you were running out of RIDs, going off to the FISMO RID master, and getting a new block of RIDs was too short. Right? The script had already run out of RIDs by that time. Microsoft changed it. It used to go 50% RID pool usage. It used to go off and ask. It's now 80%. Right? But people increase the RID block size to increase it to 2,000. So when you consumed 1,000, you went off. Okay. Some people still increase it. The problem is the RID block size is held in a 32-bit number. And with that 32-bit number, you can actually set it bigger than the overall number of RIDs you can have in the system. All right. So if I actually go in and change that number in your Active Directory, and I push it up close to that value, the next time a DC says, oh, can I have a RID pool? Yes, have the rest. And that's it. Toast. You're done. All right? There is no way back from it. So that's another possible problem. The other thing is, incorrect, one of the things is you elevate the RID pool in an AD disaster recovery. And the reason you do that is to prevent SID reuse. And then another one is there are a large number of domain controllers removed and added. Every time you remove a domain controller, you lose the RIDs. They've gone. And there was a little bug in 2008 R2, and your domain controller could actually sit there. So every 30 seconds, under rare conditions, and if you want to find out what those conditions were, have a look at the hotfix. It would sit there every 30 seconds. Oh, can I have a new set of RIDs, please? Can I have a new set of RIDs? And it was actually eating the RID pools. And if you had a very large RID pool block size, that could be a real issue. So what Server 2012, what it's done is, first of all, it starts warning you at 10% usage of the remaining RID pool size. So the first time it will warn you, at 100 million, all right? And then it recalculates what's 10% usage of the remaining block size. And then what it does is at 90% usage, where you've still got 100 million RIDs to go, it stops issuing RIDs. And what it's saying to you is, you need to sort out your Active Directory before you clear this artificial block. And of course, if you clear the artificial block and don't sort out your Active Directory, it rapidly could eat through the extra 100 million. So, you know, you need to find out why this is happening. The other thing is they capped the maximum RID block size to 15K. So this thing of consuming all the RIDs in one shot has gone. And you've also got a global RID space size unlock. And what that means is the RID pool size is actually held in a 30-bit number. It now can do 31 bits. So we can now go up, all right, double its size. And 2003, 2008 DCs can't use it. 2008 R2 with an update can use it. So what you need to be is server 2012, 2008 R2 with a little KB fix, which allows it to use this additional RID block size. There's more. What I just show you very, very briefly before we just got a couple of minutes to finish. I just want to show you the, just if you want to look at your, if it fascinates you and you want to look at your RID block size, if we just go to the tree view in LDP, and if you drill down into system, there's a RID manager dollar object, should be, there we go, and part of that is the RID available pool. And that's a 64-bit number, which I can split in the large integer converter, drop that in, and run that. And that actually shows you the, let's just do a, bring that bigger. The higher part of that, the lower part is the next pool to be allocated. The higher part of that is the maximum number of RIDs you can ever have in your domain. And if you actually want to unlock this thing, what you do is you, we need a, let's just go and grab the attribute. We need to actually modify the SID compatibility version. Where are we? We come in here. And the, let's just close that. Browse, and we want to modify. We use a blank DN, we put the attribute value in, set it to a value of 1, extended, run it, and suddenly what you'll find is parameter incorrect, SID compatible version, add, oh, I didn't add it, that's why, run, and that's modified it, and if we just close that and have another look, what you'll see is this size has suddenly dramatically increased. And if we just go into the utility large integer converter, I think if you can see, you'll see it's already increased. We've just actually bumped that up. So we've doubled the size of that. Okay, there are some other nice little features that are in there. The support for deferred index creation. I don't know if you've ever been in the situation where you've actually indexed an attribute in the AD or told it to be indexed. Exchange is a particular issue, and suddenly all your DCs are re-indexing everywhere. Well, now you can defer it. You can defer it to happen on reboot or when you do a schema update. You trigger a schema update on the DC. Off-premise domain join has been improved. It supports direct access clients. Got additional logging, LDAP behavior changes, and Active Directory-based activation. So automatic activation for Windows 8 and Server 2012 machines are in there. You still require KMS to support down-level volume licensing. Also, the service accounts now can be distributed across multiple web servers. So you can use a single service account, which is managed across multiple web servers. And we've seen the PowerShell commands for replication. So In just 1 hour and exactly 15 minutes, we've gone a whistle-stop tour of what's in Server 2012. I hope you found it useful, given you a bit of insight. I also wanted to give you a bit of a technical drill down into certain areas as well, because, you know, that's what makes these products fun, is actually digging in a little bit. The evaluations are really important, so please make sure you fill an evaluation. I read every single comment, and that's really useful as well. So if you feel you can type a few words, maybe after you've had a drink or two at the reception, think about that. Thank you very much for coming along. If you've got any questions, by all means, come down and ask them. Otherwise, maybe I'll see you on my Thursday morning session. Thank you very much.